Good evening, everybody.
Okay, so let's get going. Who's taking us through this chart?
Phil, this is Ariel. You can, and while I can take notes, but if you don't want to, I can also take over whichever method
right.
you prefer.
You know what? Give me 30 seconds. Let me get a fresh cup of coffee, and then I'll lead it, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm back. So let's get going. Among your examiner's determinations, how many did not provide the reasons on which the determination space was simply stated? The URS had been elements had been established. The two smaller providers in terms of volume said none. Professor Tushnet said the forum had decisions without any reasons whatsoever, and forum has not undertaken a specific review of decisions for this issue. So we do know that I've seen with my own eyes that some forum decisions simply said the elements have been satisfied, but didn't state how they had been satisfied in terms of what evidence there was for bad faith registration and use under the applicable burden of proof, and that's an issue that we can take up if we wish to in terms of clarifying the minimum requirements for a forum decision. So let's go on to the next one. So, did you supply the examiners with information analysis or research concerning a complaint or response that's not found within the complaint or response itself? And second question, do you provide drafts or exemplars to the examiners? If so, please explain. ADN said no to both. Forum said no to the first, but second, said that certain information are automatically generated in decision template. That seems those are not decisional elements, just factual elements. I don't see any issue raised there. MFSD says they just provide information regarding procedural matters, case management. That doesn't seem objectionable. Again, certain factual elements are captured automatically in the online dispute management system, and they encourage examiners to refer the WIPO overview to cite URS and UDRP case law that they retain significant. I think the word retain is wrong there, but it gives them, basically they encourage them to refer to the WIPO practice if they're going to cite elements. So I don't see anything in those answers that would generate issues for the working group. And Susan, when I say these, if you object in any way, please speak up. You don't have to raise your hand. We're the only two non-staff people on the call.
Certainly will. I'll definitely object, and I completely agree with you.
Okay. Next one, remedies. Provide feedback regarding any difficulties encountered in the implementation of the suspension remedy. ADN said NA, not applicable. Forum said there's a delay in the activation of URS suspension or non-implementation. of URS suspension. I'm not sure there could be a delay in not doing something, but I need to think about that. Can staff explain what MFSD had the same response? What would be a delay in non-implementation? Well, I guess that would be taking the hold off the domain that's been put on.
I just heard Susan may want to say something. Susan, do you have any input on that?
Oh, well, no, I don't. I've sort of been reading it as being that there might be a delay in the activation of the suspension or in some cases, non-implementation. But now I'm so I was reading that in a different way to Phil, but now I'm not sure. So I guess maybe we should look at the actual responses.
I think.
Or are these?
Go ahead, Ariel, one at a time.
Sorry. So what MFSD was saying is that they heard the delay to activate the suspension within 24 hours from their communications, and then they also had two reports for ICANN because the registry operator didn't implement the URS suspension. So that's basically what they answered.
All right. Well, I'm still. Maybe staff can give a written answer on that. I mean, I understand there's an adverse decision. The domain's supposed to be suspended, and there's a longer delay than there should be in suspending it. But if there's no adverse decision by the examiner, there's no suspension to implement. The only thing that would happen is any hold on the domain would be taken. The lock on the domain would be taken off. So I'm not sure what not. How there could be a delay in not doing something.
I didn't word it clearly. I was trying to summarize the response. So basically, what the registry operator was, they didn't do it, and then it was a very long delay, and the provider had to report to ICANN in order to get the registry operator to suspend the domain. So that's basically what I summarized there is a non-implementation of URS suspension. It's not really a delay of the non-implementation. It's just purely non-implementation. And then they have to get ICANN to urge the registry operator to
So there's either delay or they were told to suspend and they failed. All right, well, that is an issue we need to look at. It's certainly if a domain has been determined to be infringing by a high burden of proof and it's not suspended, then the RPM isn't working. So we need to look at why that happens. And I think that's something ICANN needs to make sure is done. They're the ones with the direct contractual relationship with the registries. Okay. Next one. Are you aware of any instances where a successful complainant has requested extension of the registration period for an additional year? If so, have any of them encountered difficulties doing so? And how was it handled? ADN says no. The other two say yes. Form says the separate roles of registry and registrar may not have been understood by one or the other. And MFSD said yes, they wanted to get it extended, but they don't have any further information. So hold on. So what seems to be going on is UDRP is an RPM where the registrar is the active party in implementing the decision. In URS, it's the registry, except there's one element, which is extension of the suspension for a year, which would where the registrar has to take a role, and some of them don't seem to understand that that's their role, so are unwilling to do that. So that is something we need to look at, because the trademark owner has that right under the mechanism. Of course, if we do something else in terms of giving a right of first refusal, first right to register the domain when it drops or something like that, this may change, but that one needs to be bookmarked as requiring further attention.
I'd agree with that, Phil, and I imagine it might be because there's this slightly odd scenario where the registrant is no longer the party.
Right.
I would imagine is not the party that's actually asking for the extension, and so there's a kind of lack of understanding, by the sound of it, about what those roles are and the fact that a third party effectively is asking for the extension to be put into place.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's a third party, and some registrars may think they have no role to play in the URS, that it's just a registry implemented RPM, and not be aware of this aspect. So that, I think that's a matter of just registrar education and making sure they understand the role. If we keep that element the availability of the additional year. All right, next one, remedies. During the additional year of URS suspension, the domain name must remain registered to the original registrant. Should the registration information be altered in such circumstances? This is really an opinion answer. ADN answered no. MFSD had no direct answer. And Forum says some examiners think it should be. You know, if we're going to educate the registrars on their responsibility, it would seem to make sense just for accuracy that if there's a one-year extension, that the control of the domain should be listed under the trademark owner, not the original registrant in some way. But another kind of technical area for the working group to look at. Next. Okay, have any of your examiners issued both default and final determinations? When the final determination changed the case outcome from that of the default? The two smaller providers said no. Forum said yes, but it's only a single case. So there's not usually deviation between a default determination and a final determination. Hey, Barry, how many final determinations were there post initial determination, post default determination? Do you have that in your statistics?
Sarah just put in the chat, I do, but not handy.
Okay, why don't you just get that back to us? But I just, it's just, you know, was it one case at a 6 or one case out of 60 would just show the percentage. And, you know, I wouldn't argue for eliminating that possibility. It's just noting that it's a rare occurrence so far in URS practice. I don't think there's any issue there for the working group. Next one. Have any of your examiners decided to publish both the default and final determinations when the final determination upheld the default determination? Oh, well, this may give us our answer. The two smallers, no. The forum said yes, 14 cases as of March 6th. So that would indicate that one case where there was a reversal was one out of 15 total, and that the forum where this has occurred issues, even though the result is identical, they issue the final determination as well, which is good. It's good to have that on the record. I don't see a working group issue. Next one. Has any determination your examiners have issued concern the same domain name at issue in a prior case? If so, have you linked the cases? Has any final determination been made by the same examiner who made the initial default determination in the same case? How many times that have occurred? The two smaller providers said no, but those are incomplete answers. I don't know if we're going to get complete answers at this point. Forum says yes, they have seen the same domain pop up more than once as the focus of a complaint. They don't link them. Most final determinations made by the same examiner as default determination. unless response was received in a language that the examiner did not speak after the default determination. So, all right. To the extent I understand that answer, I don't see a working group issue, particularly since they're switching examiners when the language requirement requires it. Next one, appeal. What percentage of your cases have been appealed? And do you understand what, do you have an opinion on why views are appeals are infrequent? The two smaller ones, zero appeals. The forum had 14 appeals covering 16 domains. So there must have been two cases that had two domains involved, and they didn't offer an opinion as to the infrequency. It might just be that the original decision was pretty clearly correct, and the registrant didn't want to lose again, didn't want to spend the time and expense to lose a second time. But I think it's just interesting data, but it doesn't suggest an issue for the working group. And of course, my opinions on this call as I wake up are not determinative for the working group. Anyone can raise an issue if they wish to propose a recommended change in policy when we get to that point in our work shortly. Yes, Ariel?
Sorry for interrupting. I didn't include the reasons in the slides. That was an oversight. So I can just read out some of the reasons the providers stated in responding to that question. The forum said it comes down to a client decision. It's just maybe not worth it for them to proceed any further. And then others say, MFSD said parties may not have reasons to appeal and may be satisfied with the outcome of the proceeding. Since the URS do not preclude subsequent UDRP proceedings, there's also the possibility to file a UDRP after the URS. And then for AD and DRC, they said the reason could include the parties are just very satisfied with the results. Also, they have alternative remedies that could be provided to them in court of complete jurisdiction. So that's some of the reasons they stated.
Yeah, that's true. Losing registrant could immediately go to court rather than use the internal appeal procedure. I don't know if we have any statistics on how many court cases. That'd be kind of hard to know. So next one, 139.
I don't necessarily see the small number of appeals as necessarily being a bad thing in any event. I mean, you know, one might view it as being support for the notion that this is meant to be in relation to cases where it's a clear-cut case and that, you know, once there's an outcome, you know, the parties, you know, do feel it's not worth taking any further.
Yeah, well, I agree, Susan. Well, number one, you know, if we assume, now it wouldn't be true possibly in every case, but if you assume that the initial determination of bad faith registration and use was correct under a high evidentiary burden, an appeal wouldn't be very likely to change the outcome unless the examiner was way off base. But I think the fact that in 14 cases it's been used shows that some registrants think there was some utility to it. Okay. Next one. How do you implement Rule 19B? Do you conduct an administrative check on the data of any additional evidence sought to be introduced? How do you determine the appellant is seeking to introduce new evidence that's in fact providing evidence that's material to determination and clearly predates the filing of the complaint? So that's the rule that lets the appeal raise new evidence so long as it's not evidence that occurred since the initial decision. ADN says they've implemented, but they haven't yet had any such situation. The MFSD provided details of the administrative review to check against any new evidence, and forum has the appellant click a button indicating additional evidence for consideration, and appellant then is able to upload it, triggering the additional payment. It's up to the panel to review the submitted evidence and make sure it complies with Rule 19B, which that seems like a reasonable approach to say, you know, it's up to the examiner to determine whether it's really new evidence that can be considered under the policy. I don't see how the operator of the, you know, the U.S. provider could do that at the initial point. It seems more like an examiner role. So I don't see any issues to forward here to the working group. But again, others can bring it up if they think there's a problem. Okay, row 136, like, other. Let's go to other. Have you undertaken any internal reviews of your supplemental rules? How often? Have you discerned a need to tighten or provide greater clarity? ADN says yes, but they didn't see any need for a change. Forum said yes, and they changed the fees for multiple domain names. That's a pricing issue. MFSD also did so and changed the fees. So other than the monetary issue, the providers haven't seen any need to change their supplemental rules as being too broad or not being sufficiently definitive. No issue screams out there. Next one, another other. Any difficulties complying with URS technical requirements such as PGP keys? Two of them said no. ADN said yes, but they're migrating to a new website. I presume that the new website will be able to better comply with those technical requirements. But this answer indicates that ADN may have been out of compliance with the technical requirements for some point in time. So I think, you know, we've got a number of issues with ADN to follow up on, the most prominent of which is that they don't communicate to the, or initially, the notice of the filing to the registrant in all the ways they're required to under the policy. So I think we need to check to make sure that they're now in technical compliance and it's not a continuing issue. Next one, another other. Do you maintain regular communications with ICANN? If so, did ICANN request any information or data from you via such communications? And what other areas of the URS do such communications touch on? ADN said yes with no details. Forum said yes, a standing request for monthly statistics, registry contact information when requesting verification and domain name locks, verifying SMD files from the TMCH, impact of MAS-2 information in the wake of GDPR. This is a very recent answer. And technical specs. MFSD has a similarly detailed answer, pretty similar to the forums. So I think what we glean from this is that the providers do have some regular communication on technical and implementation issues with ICANN, which is good. It would be concerning if they hadn't had any communications in all this time. Can I just ask who joined us from the 703-9530 number?
That is me, Phil, Kathy Kleinman. Good morning, everybody.
Hi, Kathy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Kathy, we made an executive decision at the beginning, or I did, that since there were just 15 questions to review, it was best to plow through, even though we had a small number of members, and bookmark any answers that suggest to continue. some follow-up work for the working group or might suggest some need to consider a policy change. So that's how we're proceeding.
Makes sense. Thanks much. I'll just listen in the background.
And on some of the other stuff, we're just going to have staff bring it to our attention by email, but we wanted to just get through the 15 remaining answers we hadn't covered yet. And I think we're pretty close to done with that. Let's go on to the next one. Thank you. Well, Kathy, you came in for the last question.
Perfect timing.
Perfect timing. And it's 34 after the hour. So staff, remind me, what was the other thing we might have discussed on this call?
And this is Ariel. I don't think we have any remaining items except for just notify the sub-team if they see any issues worth further discussion, they can bring up via email. And then we also have half of the spreadsheet that's the responses are similar from the providers. And so the sub-team are welcome to look through that and bring up any issues. And then staff also plan to do a detailed review of these responses. And if we see any issues worth further discussion or any follow-up questions that should be developed to send to the providers, we can also make a list of that too. So that's just an action item for the sub-team and an action item for the staff to do that.
Okay. And when does staff contemplate finishing its own review of the similar answers and forwarding any analysis where they think it raises issues to the working group? Just what's the time frame for that?
This is Ariel again. I think if we look at the timeline, there's a call, I think the first week of August is for all the sub-teams to provide a report to the full working group on their progress and status. And so if we work backwards, then we staff should have finished our review and issue identification maybe 1 week or for 2 weeks before that August meeting. I just need to double check. I think it's August 8th. That's the meeting for sub-teams to report to us.
Right. So in the next week, 10 days, you should be finished. So I suggest you, staff, finish that review and then forward all those similar questions to the members of this sub-team with any ones that staff, identifying any ones that staff believes might require some further discussion in the working group and in terms of problems, you know, in implementing the policy or suggesting possible consideration of modifications. Then we can conduct our own review and be all ready to have that discussion on August 8th.
Oh, sorry. This is Ariel again. I misspoke and I think I misremembered. It's actually August 1st is the full working group meeting. And with that, then we will work faster and get the identification.
So I would say aim within a week. Since that's 2 weeks away, aim to get that information back to us within a week.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Susan, Kathy, did you have anything else you wanted to add before we close down this call?
No, I don't.
Not from me, though. I'm happy.
Okay. All right, and the answers that suggested some possible follow-up by the working group are noted in the action items. So, Kathy, when you get those action items later today, you can see where we thought some additional inquiry or by the working group might be required based on the answers.
Terrific. And thanks to the sub-team and Chief Phil for so much work on this. You guys by far had the longest set of questions. Just amazing work.
Thank you. Thank you. So thank everyone. Kathy, since you're on, we've got two sub-team calls at 1 p.m. Which one are you planning to be on?
I was going to be on the TMCH sub-team. How about you? The one closing up the survey with the analysis group.
Let me just. So at one, we've got the one on the data, subteam for data, and one for document. So which of those would that be, Kathy?
Data.
Data.
That was data.
And do we know which one Brian's going to be on?
I assume he's going to be on the documents because he's kind of the acting co-chair of that.
Okay. Well, I can't be on both. I'll have to decide which one I should be on.
You can be half and half, spend, or have two phones on your ears.
That would be confusing.
That would be.
I'll figure it out. Well, it sounds like both are covered, and I have my choice of which one to join. So I'll figure that out between now and one.
Terrific.
Okay.
I'm just assuming Brian's going to be on this call.
Yeah, he's been on kind of shepherding that one, so I assume he's going to be on. Does staff know if he's planning to be on that?
Yeah, Phil, this is Julie. Our understanding is he'll be on that call, the document subteam call.
Okay. All right. So I'll be on one of them at 1 p.m. Thank you, staff. Thanks, Kathy, for joining. Thank you, Susan, for joining. And we are done, and you have 20 minutes of your life back. Goodbye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Phil.
Great. Thanks.
And everyone.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for joining. This concludes today's call. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you.